Today, our emphasis is on GI infections, parasites, fissures, diverticulitis, and so forth, things having to do with the gastrointestinal tract. And I have a couple of things that I would like to finish up on, things that we have had from previous days in our seminar. So let me just finish up those first, and then we'll get into the gastrointestinal matters. I'd like to mention concerning poison ivy that thin slices of onion bandaged to the rash with a loose bandage can be very helpful with poison ivy. I have a friend, a minister, who is extremely allergic to poison ivy. His young son, who must be about 8 or 10 years old now, is also extremely allergic to poison ivy. One day, a group of us went for a walk, and the two of them were along. And I didn't see that they got near the poison ivy, but when we came back, the next day, they both had a case of poison ivy. And I had been showing some people and identifying some people who were on our walk, identifying for them poison ivy and poison oak. But they didn't even approach it, so I don't know how they got it. But somehow they got, may have been the wind that carried something to them, or I don't know what it was. But at any rate, the minister was in the pulpit the following Sabbath, and I noticed that he was reaching his hand inside his jacket and scratching a little bit there. So after the service was over, I asked him if he would like to try a remedy that was a very helpful remedy. He said, "Anything, it's all over me." And he was not the kind of person who just gets it in one patch, but when he's exposed to it, it goes all over, which is the second of the two common ways that we get poison ivy. We get a contact dermatitis, and we also get an allergic reaction, which is a general reaction. Most people will get a contact dermatitis. That's from the irritation of the oil. But not everybody will get the total dermatitis that comes about from contact with the antigen. But he put the onion on just a few places where it was the most itchy, and it helped it so much that those were better than his other places where he hadn't been so itchy. And so he put the thin slices of onion all over himself, and he smelled like an onion factory. But it wasn't very long before he was entirely well from it. So you can try some of these things and see if that won't be helpful to you. Another thing I didn't mention yesterday was on eczema. Eczema is often on the hands, but wherever it may be, if you will make what is called Vaseline milk, what we call Vaseline milk, it's easy to make it. Take any kind of petroleum jelly, and after the hands are washed, preferably without soap unless they are truly soiled, because soap is drying and can also cause a problem for people. A little aloe vera gel can be used to wash the hands, and it gives a little slipperiness and emulsification of soilage on the hands, and can be helpful. But then after rinsing well, then take a small lump of petroleum jelly and rub it between the hands. And as you rub it, you'll notice that it develops a little friction, and so it becomes a little difficult to get it to emulsify in the water that you have on your hands. And then it should be rubbed in the direction, spread on very gently, in the direction of skin lines, not across the way the skin lines go in the body. Rubbing across the skin lines in this way breaks up these tiny little skin lines where there are cracks and keeps it going. That's what makes itching or scratching of eczema keep it going. So while the scratching does not cause it, it does keep it going. Skin diseases are very difficult to diagnose. Sometimes we treat a patient with a skin problem and they don't respond, and we think, oh, well, we'll get a dermatologist to just tell us what this is and then everything will be fine. So we send the patient to the dermatologist and he makes a diagnosis. And then the patient follows the dermatologist's instructions and doesn't get any better, so they go to another dermatologist who makes yet a third diagnosis. We made one, the first dermatologist, the second dermatologist, each made a diagnosis. So you can see that it is difficult to diagnose skin lesions, and even experts are often not able to do so. So if you look at a skin lesion and you think it's this or that, and the dermatologist thinks it's something else, he may be right, or she, but you may be right too, so don't give up your diagnosis of a skin ailment easily. Question or comment?
No, I was going to say the same thing. They don't always know what it is. Yes. I went to a dermatologist, and he said what I had was flea bites. I said, no, yes. I had scabies, because I got it from the cat, you know?
Yes.
And the vet was the one that told me, don't get the cat close to you because you'll get it.
Yes.
But of course, I was treating the cat and I got it.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, it's,
and he didn't even know what it was.
Yes, a dermatologist will often be confused as to what it is. And the reason for that points up a very good spiritual lesson. Every human being is different from every other human being. The Bible says that if we are wise, we can shine as stars forever. And I'm sure you know in this modern age of astronomy that every star is different from every other one, sends out a different light wave. So some are blue, some are tan, some are orange, some are red. Some send out a lot of radio waves, some send out a few, some send out this kind of radio wave. Various kinds of cosmic radiation come from these. They're all different. What would it be like if we didn't have one of those stars? If it just suddenly dropped out from space, we would be in trouble, wouldn't we? It is the same way with human beings. If one of us is not in heaven, our Heavenly Father will be greatly sorrowful that we're not there. It will leave a great void. It is for this reason that we urge people to examine themselves, make certain that you do not have something that you have done all your life, perhaps, and you ignore it. Everybody else around you does the same thing, and you ignore it because you think it's what everybody does. Maybe Jesus himself did this sin that I'm doing, and so I don't have to worry about it. But that really is not true. There is no sin that we do that does not separate us from God. And if we can, Jesus never sinned, did he? And so he could not have done any of those things that we pass by in our own lives and we say, it's all right, it's such a small thing. I don't have to worry about this small thing. But we will all be missed. Every one of us will be missed if we are not in heaven with the Lord. Yes?
I think what you might have been referring to is like, mm-hmm. Fish or meat. Jesus ate fish or meat.
Yes, it's not a sin.
It wouldn't be right to do it because it's supposed to be.
That's right.
It's
not a sin for Jesus.
Because Jesus ate it, it's all right for us to eat it.
Yes. such things as the way we handle our tongues. Thank you. We may get to thinking there's no problem with this because everybody does it. Everybody has these little slips of the tongue. Probably Jesus did too. But if he ever had had one, he would not have been our Savior, would he? We would have been lost permanently. The human race would have been lost. Now, another thing that I want to talk with you about before we get into the gastrointestinal tract, and you're receiving a handout right now on the gastrointestinal tract, but I want to mention a few things about collagen disease that I didn't get around to talking about yesterday. So put your gastrointestinal handout away for a few minutes until I can talk with you about collagen diseases. They are getting more common in our age. Young people from the ages of 10 to 40 are more likely to get it, more likely to come down with a collagen disease than are people who are over 40 or under 10. But no age is entirely immune to collagen diseases. Collagen diseases are diseases of a form of connective tissue called collagen. And we have it everywhere, especially in the skin, in the lungs, in the gastrointestinal tract, around the joints, and in the kidneys, and around all of our blood vessels. Therefore, when we get a collagen disease, those are the places that are stricken. We could expect then to have a rash because there's much collagen in the skin. We could expect to have kidney problems. There's much collagen there. We could expect that blood vessels would get an arteritis or a phlebitis. Joints would get an arthritis. The gastrointestinal tract would have some kind of gastroenteritis. And all of those things are true. People who die from a collagen disease often die, usually die, from pneumonia or kidney problems or blood vessel problems in some way. The rash of the commonest collagen disease, we suppose it's the commonest. There may be something that we have diagnosed as something else that really is a collagen disease. But lupus or lupus erythematosus disseminatum is probably the commonest one. So we generally call it lupus or SLE, systemic lupus erythematosus. This disease often begins with a butterfly rash. Cheeks, chin, and a little in the middle of the forehead so that it looks like a butterfly. It can't even go down on the sternum. While that's the commonest form of rash, it isn't the only one. We can have a rash that covers the entire body or just some other part of the body. They may start their disease with pneumonia or nephritis or arthritis. That's another very common first manifestation of lupus. Pain in the joints. Now, what can we do to treat it? Number one, the most favorable diet is, what do you suppose? A totally vegetarian diet. No question but that people with collagen disease who take a vegetarian diet, that's no meat, milk, eggs, or cheese, they fare better. They will live longer. They will have fewer complications and fewer problems of all kinds. And so we start right out with a totally vegetarian diet. We try to teach people to have a vegetarian diet that is at least as palatable as their meat-based diet had been. And in my experience, my personal experience, the kind of diet that does not have meat, milk, eggs, and cheese is far more varied, far more interesting. In fact, it is like high adventure to eat at my house. Can't wait to get there to see what Diane has made today. And I know that every meal is going to be a little different. Sometimes I complain about that. I say, Diane, when are we going to have this or that again? And, well, what would you like me to omit that I have recently had to have this or that that you want? And I can't think of anything. The second thing is exercise. Often, these people have a sensitivity to sun. Therefore, you must be careful about sunning for them. In the South, we used to have a custom where the women went promenading on a Sabbath afternoon with a parasol. You remember that? Remember those days? We'd have these nice little silk parasols with little fringes and hand-painted. And we'd go on the promenade with the parasol. Of course, we never let the sun hit our skin in those days. Now, in our sun-worshipping days, where people lie out in the sun unclothed, much to the dermatologist's disdain, they tell people to avoid the sun. And it is true that any tanning that we ever do, tanning is a reaction to sun radiation. It is a scarring type of reaction. It is an aging reaction on the skin. And so we should protect the skin as well as we can from the sun, especially those rays between 10 and 4 every day. But exercise is best for the collagen disease patient out of doors. In fact, it is roughly twice as beneficial as any kind of gym type of workout that they could do indoors. And so we like to have them out of doors, but that means avoiding the sun for the most part. So we say early in the morning and late in the day. And for women, I believe that early in the morning is the most favorable time for us to get exercise out of doors. When the dew is still on the grass and the negative air ions are plentiful out of doors, and women who get exercise on a daily basis will feel better as a general rule than they would feel if they did not exercise at that time. Exercise out of doors prevents depression, fatigue, muscle aches and pains, and physical degeneration and weakness, and of course it enhances the effectiveness of the immune system. Another thing that we have found very good in all collagen diseases is fever treatments. We have also found that the short cold bath can be helpful. These are described in our book, Home Remedies. Now, if the patient doesn't tolerate the fever treatments, don't insist that they have them, then just give them the short cold bath, because some patients just feel faint or they feel claustrophobic in a hot bath. Warm clay baths we have found to be very beneficial, and we can dig clay from most places in the world just by digging down beyond the sand and the gravel, and you will eventually come to clay if you persist long enough in most places. And whatever clay you have, whether it is red or white or gray or green, you may use it. It's right down there. It's under the ground. Oh, no. Well, you take some clay and mix it with water and use it as a bath. You may also purchase bentonite clay. You may purchase the green clay from France and many other kinds of clay that you can get that are useful in this regard, Nancy.
Do you need to sterilize it first?
No. No, you can just use it just as it is, unless it is from a contaminated area, and then I wouldn't use it anyway.
Where do you put it? Anywhere on your body?
You can use it as a compress anywhere on the body, but as a bath, you put it in the bathtub, and then all you have to do is deal with the clay after the water goes out. You may use, we do it in different ways, but the one that when we use bentonite, we just dissolve it in the water and put it in the bath, enough to make it look quite milky. But when we are doing a clay bath with clay that we have ourselves dug, we put it in we try to use an outdoor portable spa or bathtub that we use for just that purpose. And we put enough clay in so that when we mix it up, it's about the consistency of very soft peanut butter. And they just get in the bath and soak in it for a while. We did not know that clay had any beneficial effect. I've heard of this since I was a little girl. Jesus used the clay poultice on the eyes of the patient who couldn't see to great effectiveness, just on the eyelids. When I became a physician, I had a great disdain for all kinds of simple remedies. My opinion of them was that they worked until they worked to soothe the patient's nerves until the real remedies could be given, which were my drugs or surgery. But since we have become more educated, have learned that there are truly many ways to treat disease, not just drugs and surgery, we began to have some faith in the simple remedies. And clay was one of those. And the thing that got me started on having faith in clay was the work of some surgeons who, of course, at that time, I naturally had confidence in those who were of my profession and little confidence in those who were not of my profession who were involved in the healing arts. I want to be sure that you know that I have a respect for all physicians who are in the healing, licensed to practice the healing arts, the chiropractors, the homeopaths, the osteopaths, any other physician. Physicians who are licensed to practice the healing arts have a certain thing that they can offer to us. I don't know of any discipline that I have mentioned that doesn't have an undesirable part, including allopathy, which is that the MD, which I was trained in. All schools of the healing arts have some unwanted factors in it. We should learn to take the best of each one, each school of the healing arts, and avoid all of the unwanted parts, all of the unwanted parts of each school of the healing arts, which takes quite a study. But some surgeons made an extract of clay and bandaged their surgical wounds with the clay, with pharmaceuticals, and with nothing. Those that were bandaged with the clay had the fastest healing and the fewest complications. Next, those that had nothing, just plain bandage, just a plain dry sterile bandage every day. And the third, those that had the pharmaceuticals. In fact, there were many complications and infections and various things that the other two groups did not have, which was very revealing to me. And I began to have a little shakiness of my confidence in allopathy with that very study. But these are all things that can be done. Let's go on with some of the things that you can use. for collagen diseases. Now, I hope that you will notice that these are things that have a wide spread of effectiveness, not just for collagen diseases, but for many other things as well. The next, some herbal remedies. Echinacea is one of the few things that we know to medical science that will boost the effectiveness of the immune system. Take a heaping tablespoonful in a quart of water and boil it gently for about 20 to 25 minutes. The gentlest boil that you can get, that is one day's dose. If you wish, you can add up to 7 other herbs in that one quart of water. But once you pass about 7 herbs, you will not get a good extraction from it. Licorice, a teaspoonful of licorice powder, or if you're going to use it only a week, you could use a tablespoon of licorice powder. But don't use licorice for a long period of time, because it has a sort of steroidal, adrenal steroidal effect, and it can imbalance your electrolytes, like the various minerals of the body. And then the third one is wild yam. These three boost the immune system functioning and have somewhat of a cortisone type of effect. Cortical steroids, adrenal cortical steroids. There are many others. The wild yam is a tablespoonful too. So it's a tablespoon. Well, you can use a tablespoonful of all of them, but don't use licorice for a long time. Echinacea, you can use it forever. A quart of water in each one of these. The same quart. Then, the use of drugs in collagen diseases should be avoided as much as possible. There are no drugs that will not have some injurious effect on the human body. And when it is sick, it has, especially with a chronic, incurable, serious disease like the collagen diseases are, all drugs should be avoided as much as possible. That would be such things as contraceptive pills and penicillin and sulfonamides and cimetidine and corticosteroids. Corticosteroids are typically used for the collagen diseases in ordinary medicine, but I would use them if I ever used them. It would be only as an attempt at a life-saving measure when everything else had failed and I was trying everything systematically. I might then try it. But as to put a person on a steroid with the intention that they would be on it the rest of their lives, I would not do that. Then, and I might say that there is no alteration in the course of the disease, of a collagen disease, with steroids. No alteration in the course. Their symptoms may clear dramatically, but they still go right ahead with the... In fact, I believe if studies were done, it would be shown that with steroids, they have a shorter lifespan and more complications eventually with steroids like cortisone than without them. To be avoided along with the drugs are such things as various cosmetics, all hair coloring agents, hair sprays, and all cosmetics to which the person is sensitive, perfumes and cleaning agents, any of these. The person should be very careful if they even have a sense that it is unpleasant to be around any one of these. They should avoid it totally. Silicone gel breast implants may be one of the causes of autoimmune diseases such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. And if you'd like a reference on that, Lancet, which is probably the most prestigious British medical journal, Lancet, November 28, 1992. All right. There's much more that could be said on collagen diseases. There are many other collagen diseases besides lupus, like dermatomyositis and scleroderma, probably rheumatoid arthritis, but we will stop at that point. And now we will go to gastrointestinal problems. Take your handout, and you will notice there that the first one on your list is anemia. Anemia is not a gastrointestinal disorder directly, but it can result from some peptic ulcers, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, intestinal parasites, malabsorption syndromes, imbalances of nutrients and the like. All of these can cause anemia. So I thought I'd spend a little while talking with you about anemia. Notice in the first paragraph that there are several different kinds. Those due to nutrient deficiencies like deficiencies of iron, copper, cobalt, nickel, folic acid, vitamins B6 and B12, and protein. So you can see that anemia is not a simple disorder. Can be, even if it is nutritional, it can be very complicated. And then it can be due to those, it is those anemias due to suppression of the bone marrow. Suppression of the bone marrow, we first think of drugs with a suppression of the bone marrow. But all kinds of toxic states, heavy metal toxicities like lead, and many other toxic states can result in anemia. The toxicity of cancer can result in anemia. Especially cancer of the cecum can result in anemia. Very profound anemias can have, as that can be the first herald of cancer of the cecum. Notice the symptoms. Oh, I didn't mention blood loss. Chronic blood loss is probably the commonest cause of anemia worldwide, from such things as intestinal parasites, menstrual losses, peptic ulcers, and other gastrointestinal disorders. Symptoms are such things as easy tiring, headache, dizziness, an unusual ringing in the ears, rapid heart rate, shortness of breath on exertion, cravings for unusual substances such as starch, clay, ice, and abnormal sensations on the skin, and a variety of other things that can be symptoms of anemia. Notice that these are the symptoms of 40 other diseases that you could just think of right off, so that they are nonspecific. Often a woman will say, well, I feel tired. My hemoglobin must be low. But there are many other reasons why she may be tired or feel weak, and she should look to all of her life and not just to her anemia. Notice in the fourth paragraph on page one that only 5 to 10% of the iron in food is taken up by the body in all kinds of normal cases. But if we are iron deficient, we can take up as much as 45% or more of the iron in our food. Why is that? Do you have an idea why it is that iron, that all the iron in our food is not taken up? Who has an idea about why is it? All right, Celeste has said that maybe it's an imbalance in calcium that might occur because we take up too much iron. That is true. That's one thing. what else? Can you think of anything that might be a problem if we take up too much iron? Yes.
Oh, I was going to say maybe the body just uses what it needs. But you're talking about in a deficiency. That it's
no. What I mean is this, that we just don't take it up. It's there in the food. But we only take up 5%. Why? It is a protective feature. Our great divine designer did not make us so that we would take up more. If we take up more, we become iron overloaded and die. Ptosis is a big problem for people who have iron overload, who take up too much iron. Under what circumstances would just an ordinary person take up too much iron? Stress, supplements, enrichment of food. But we have a disorder called stress polycythemia, or too many blood cells. That's polycythemia. Too many blood cells caused by stress. Stress polycythemia. A lot of women have that, and it causes fatigue. If a woman has a hemoglobin above about 12.5 grams, as it gets higher and higher, she experiences more and more fatigue. Do you see? Because blood is, iron is heavy, and when we pump it around, it can cause us to have a problem. All right, let's go to the treatment of anemia. You will see a number of treatments here. I think they're probably all self-explanatory. Maybe I could mention about number 2, avoid hot or spicy foods, alcohol and vinegar. These are irritants for the intestinal tract and can cause, this is on page 1, item 2 down at the bottom, can cause irritation of the gastrointestinal tract with bleeding and the loss of iron in this way. Significant quantities can be lost in this way. You will notice in item number 1 under treatment that several are mentioned as either tying up nutrients, other nutrients like calcium or the B vitamins or vitamin C. We can, if we overload on one nutrient or we take certain things, certain foods, they often interfere with our absorption of something else. In adults, milk interferes with our nutrient balance. A divine designer made milk and dairy products for babies, for young animals, for baby calves and baby humans and baby cats. But he intended that we should be weaned. And most of us are old enough now that we could be. Yes, Brother Tim. How do total vegetarians prevent pernicious anemia? We have not found pernicious anemia as common among total vegetarians as among meat eaters. And that's a big study, but you will find this discussed in our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians. Vegetarian foods do not have, non-animal foods do not have a regular source of B12. The thing that causes pernicious anemia is not a dietary deficiency of B12. The thing that causes pernicious anemia is a stomach problem, a genetic deficiency of intrinsic factor, hydrochloric acid, or it may be due to an operation on the small bowel in which the terminal ileum is removed and the person gets pernicious anemia because they can't absorb B12 in the place where it is most readily absorbed. Vegetarians need far less B12 than do those who use animal products. And let me just show you how that looks on the board. For a meat-eating person, a meat eater, they will need, under ordinary circumstances, let us just say about 500. That should be your micrograms per dill. That should be your level. Then an ovo-lacto vegetarian will just round these off. There is a range, of course. We'll need about 300. A total vegetarian or a vegan will need less than 100 to stay in the same balance. So, well, that's the unit that the laboratory measures, and it's a little different in different laboratories. So I'll just give you what is customarily used. Now, in our food today, in meat and milk, because of apparently the use of antibiotics so widely, meat, milk, eggs, and cheese have less B12 than they ever have before. And so we are in a problem with B12. Not just, you know, it's always something that must be thought of. All right, let's go on. Since iron deficiency anemia is the commonest, is one of the commonest ones among women, notice number 3. Eat very generously of all of these foods that are listed here. Dried fruits, greens of all kinds, whole grains, no refined or polished grains. And these will just do wonders toward bringing up your iron intake. And then if you will use vitamin foods that are high in vitamin C or lemon juice, this will enhance your iron absorption. Dried fruits contain certain factors that are favorable for hemoglobin development. So this will increase the likelihood that you will get plenty of iron and you will absorb it in a proper way, even up to 45% or more. Yes. What about sulfured dried fruit? Usually you can get the unsulfured variety. They don't look as pretty, but and sulfur is a normal compound that the body can deal with and is has a requirement in human nutrition. Doesn't need to be regarded as a poison, but many of us, including myself, may want to avoid its addition to our food. So just get the unsulfured kind. Now let's take a look at page 2, and you'll notice that item number 4 is exercise, and that an anemia herb is angelica. You can use that. And then number 5 is massage. Number 6 is do not use tea and coffee because it decreases iron absorption, even if it's decaffeinated. And for people who use iron cookware, they can significantly increase the total iron content of the diet by doing so. I'm sorry? That's good if you've got anemia. Now let's notice this next, that for parasites and amoeba, there are certain things that you can do that will get rid of these so that you don't have to have parasites. Garlic in large doses, like a whole globe of it, can be taken with meals. If it causes nausea, as it will in many people if they take it on an empty stomach, then it can be taken with the meal, but a lot of people don't like it that well. They need to take it as medicine. So if they take it as medicine, then just chop it up finely, swallow it down, and rinse it down with some water, and hope you can hold it down. Swallowing it whole does not give you a good benefit from it, so you need to have it chopped. You can mince it and put it in capsules. Yes, you can. Yes. Yes, oranges are on the list of the top 10 food groups causing food sensitivities. Use something else. Just avoid it if you're sensitive to it. Then notice that artemisia can be taken, and activated charcoal. And then you can also use Nutribiotic. That's the next one, the last paragraph there. Yes.
I was going to say, for me, I found that I just put a little bit of lemon juice.
Yes.
Chop up the garlic, put a little bit of lemon juice.
Yes.
And put some water on it.
Garlic and lemon juice.
Uh-huh.
And water.
Drink it like that.
And drink it right down.
I don't have any problem. I can't take it the other way.
Yes.
I tried to take it some other way, but it doesn't work. But for me,
lemon juice is very good. In fact, those of you who just love garlic, that's a very good way to season your food. Blenderizing garlic and lemon juice and putting it in a little condiment type of pitcher and pass it around and let people pour it on the food. All right, let's go on now to enemas. You will see a little section there on enemas. Then on page 3, section on intestinal parasites. And I'd like to mention that there are many herbs that have antimicrobial factors. Now we know that certain things that we do in hydrotherapy can encourage an antibacterial or antifungal or antiviral reaction. But notice these. Garlic has been used to treat cryptococcal meningitis. Nearly a 70% effectiveness in treatment has been obtained in some studies. Garlic is effective in inhibiting Staphylococcus, Escherichia coli, Streptococcus, and Salmonella. It will also inhibit Shigella, which is another disease like Salmonella, a typhoid type of germ disease. Boiling for a few seconds causes a marked loss in antibacterial potency of garlic, but does not affect the benefits in asthma or blood pressure or the antiplatelet stickiness factor. Garlic loses its efficiency when administered continuously. The liver sort of learns to denature the active ingredient. And so for those of us who use it a lot in our food, it might not be as effective for us as an antibacterial agent. Some infections of the gastrointestinal tract are mentioned here. Parasites, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, fungi, rickettsiae may all cause infections. Fortunately, a group of herbs have properties that will work against these. Garlic, golden seal, comfrey, usnea, grapefruit seed extract. Then a section on pinworms. This is, in the United States, the commonest intestinal parasite that we have. I enjoy parasitology. I love looking at them under the microscope, the little larvae and the eggs. But we don't have many parasites anymore in this part of the country. So I don't get to see them very often. But at one time, it represented my favorite part of microscopy, looking at these little, or looking for these little eggs or little worms. They're beautiful little shapes and designs, and when we color them, they take on a beautiful color. And so it was always a joy to me, and sometimes I sort of entertained myself with looking at them when I should have been working. But you can see some ways to treat people with pinworms, and all of these can be helpful. Activated charcoal, a hot water enema. But I'd like to mention that with children, you must not give a child more than one child-size enema per day. From time to time, there is a case reported of a fatality in a child whose relatives were overly vigorous in giving enemas. And they absorb too much water. They get a dilution of their minerals, and they die of mineral deficiency, especially salt deficiency. Generally, we can use what is called Young's Rule. Is that on here anywhere?
Yes, number two.
Okay, Young's Rule, page 4, item number 2. Young's Rule is that you divide the age by the age plus 12. And that will give you the child's dose. Divide the age by the age plus 12. So it will give you a fractionated dose of the adult's dose. 1/4 or 1/5, so forth, the child's age by the child's age plus 12. All right, let's go to another affliction, and that is pruritus ani. This is itchiness around the anus, and people who have this can be seriously afflicted with it. It can be the bane of the life. I just recently talked with a man who was hoping that we have some help for him, and I hope that what we have told him to do will be helpful. He told me that he had had this affliction seriously for 4 years, and he'd been treated with a variety of different kinds of treatments, none of them successful for him. The first thing that you must do with pruritus ani is to believe that it is due to a food sensitivity, since that's the commonest thing. Pruritus ani may occur because of pinworm infestation. Pinworm infestation can cause intense itching as can scabies. And since this is mainly a children's disease, clip the fingernails of children and give them fingernail clippers so that they can keep their nails clipped very closely. Because they scratch, they get the eggs under their fingernails, and then they spread it to their brothers and sisters or classmates. And so it can spread everywhere from one child. Generally, adults don't get pinworms. They can, but it's not the rule. They usually have a little resistance against pinworms.
But I can say garlic does help.
Garlic is a great help. And you can see a number of things here under this condition which are very helpful. Notice item number 1, a perineal pore each time the bathroom is used. Avoid the use of drugs of any kind, since they can cause pruritus ani. And alcoholic beverages, milk, coffee, all the brown drink relatives of coffee, citrus fruits and juices, tomatoes, chocolate, nuts, popcorn, and highly seasoned or spicy foods. A lot of things can cause a person to have pruritus ani. Then hot sitz baths. Never use soap on the perineum in people who have any kind of problem on the perineum. Cleanse the skin with plain water and just rubbing with the hands usually, or with a washcloth. And after bowel movements or voiding, one should wipe the area with a wet paper towel or a wet piece of cotton cloth rather than toilet tissue if toilet tissue irritates the skin, which it does in some people. In fact, that can be a cause of pruritus ani, a sensitivity to toilet tissue.
It could be the colors.
It can be the fragrances. It can be antiseptic substances put in it. And bleach in your clothing, detergents in the clothing. These people often have to have their clothing rinsed twice or more to get the detergents out of their clothing. Notice that aloe vera gel or a little bit of aloe scraped from the interior of an aloe vera leaf can be helpful. Hemorrhoids, varicose veins, and diverticula are all three caused by the same thing. Hemorrhoids are little dilated blood vessels right around the anus. And the cause of all three of these is increased intra-abdominal pressure. Tight bands around the waist, which increase the intra-abdominal pressure. Gas-forming foods, which will increase the intra-abdominal pressure. Of course, pregnancy, being overweight, being constipated, all of these can cause an increase in intra-abdominal pressure, and that then promotes hemorrhoids and varicose veins and diverticula. Hot sitz bath is the treatment of choice. There's nothing any better known to the healing arts.
You know what I found real good for hemorrhoids?
What is that?
Because one time I had a real bad attack. I couldn't sit or do anything. A hot tea bag.
Oh, yes, a hot tea bag. I think we may mention that somewhere. Yes, number 8, an astringent tea such as golden seal or witch hazel. You can make the tea and dip a cloth in it, but you can get the tea bags and use the tea bag. Just moisten it in warm water or cool water and just place it right on the swollen, thrombosed, irritated hemorrhoids. Petroleum jelly can be very helpful. It is as helpful as most hemorrhoidal creams for just ordinary cases. But notice that there are a number of things that you can do to prevent them from flaring up. Item number 6, several times an hour, squeeze the muscles of the perineum as if forcefully cutting off the urine flow and hold that for 5 to 10 seconds. This procedure will empty the hemorrhoidal veins and bring in fresh blood for healing. Now, when a person begins to feel that a hemorrhoid may be flaring up, it is at that moment, that you will be the most effective in treating it. If you wait until it is thrombosed or it is already ulcerated, or badly infected, or you've got a fungus infection in it, none of your treatments will be as effective as it would be in the very beginning. This points up a principle. This is the primary principle in using home remedies. Get started early. Do not ignore a symptom. If you have a symptom of any kind, whether it be a symptom inside the mouth or of a sore throat or of an arthritic joint, whatever it may be, the sooner you get started with it, the better it is. With the hemorrhoids, if you notice that they're feeling a little full or congested or inflamed, go through this little squeezing action several times an hour. And often the irritation will not continue. It will heal itself and you won't have any serious problem with it. Notice that item number 4 mentions onions and garlic. Boiled onions can be eaten. The aloe can be prepared by cutting a stalk, peeling, and inserting it into the rectum about 2 inches. That's a very good remedy for hemorrhoids. A garlic bulb, just one little clove, can be peeled, scraped, and inserted at bedtime as a suppository in some people. Now, some people will have a problem with that. They will get an irritation from the garlic. So before you do this remedy, you should check yourself to see if you're sensitive. Take a thin slice of garlic, put it on your forearm on the non-hairy side, cover it with a little piece of tape, let it stay overnight, and if you do not react to it with redness, you probably are not sensitive to it.
What does that do? Does it shrink them or what?
Yes, it has a healing effect. It shrinks them. It has a little astringent action, but it also has antibacterial functions, which can greatly help. Yes?
So that tell whether you're sensitive to it on the inside also?
Generally, if you put it on the skin, if you are sensitive to it in the anal area, you'll be sensitive to it on the skin because the skin, the anus, is skin. Sorry?
Yeah.
You've got a good chance that it will help you to locate those of sensitivity anywhere. But this kind of thing won't reveal them all, as you know if you've ever had skin sensitivity tests in a doctor's office. He may give you 30 or 40 different skin tests, and you may react to some things that you have never contacted in your whole life. So how could you be allergic to it? You know. So it may reveal things that are not there, and it may not tell you some things that are there. So it's not as important as knowing by eating it. You eat it, if it upsets you, then you know that you're sensitive to it. That's why we do not use skin tests as a general rule, because they don't test right down where we live, you see. They test at some place on the skin for something that's a bronchial problem or a gastrointestinal problem or a stomach problem. There are many other things given here for hemorrhoids, and you will notice as you read them that they could be helpful for a variety of other disorders. Page 7 is diverticulosis and diverticulitis. The interior of the bowel, if there is increased pressure on the inside, can balloon out at a place where it has a weakness. So if there is a place where you have a weakness, if the pressure increases inside, let's say the colon, then you can push out a little balloon, just as you can in a balloon. If you make a little bubble on the side of the balloon, then you have a diverticulum sticking out, which communicates with the interior. And so anything that would be on the inside could get inside the little diverticulum, like fecal material or seeds or fiber or anything, acids that are formed in response to the digestion of sugars. So there are many, many things that could occur that would irritate a diverticulum. Generally speaking, fiber helps diverticula to empty themselves so that they still have a little bit of muscle on the outside and they can empty themselves if we have a high fiber diet. So that's the best diet for people with diverticulosis and diverticulitis. The itis part means an inflammation of the condition. And it can give just terrible pain for years. There are many suggestions that are given here, many things that we use to tell people what to do for diverticula. And a part of these are the same things we tell people to do in the case of hemorrhoids. All right, I'd like to take just a few minutes to give you an opportunity to ask questions if you would like, and perhaps some of you have something left over from other times that you might like to be told about. Yes, Sister Samantha. Yes.
Is that a beneficial
treadmills?
Walking, you know, in some, well, where we live, for example, in Michigan, the winters are very long and very cold, and people don't go outside, they're still in Doha, you know.
Yes.
They don't walk very much, and I'm wondering about the machines that people have in their homes. Are those as effective as going outside?
Are machines used for exercise as effective as going outside? Not quite, but considering the alternative, not going outside, it's far better than going outside. Also for women who do not dare go outside their apartments in large cities because of the dangers of the street. For them, they should provide for themselves some exercise machines so that they can do good exercise and keep the muscles in good tone, even though they have to be indoors. Question.
Yeah, you mentioned ginger, that it's like an irritant.
Yes.
Is it always bad?
Is ginger always bad? No. It can be used occasionally for nausea. For motion sickness, can be used in that way. So it's very good. It's not a good tea. Yes, we should not take ginger on a regular basis. Just that once or twice in a lifetime when you're seasick, you could then use it. Oh, sorry? Fresh ginger? Fresh ginger, in my knowledge of it, does have the eugenol in it. Isn't it eugenol or is it myristicin? Aromatic oil that is toxic to the body, irritating, and does increase one's risk of getting cancer. In countries of the world where they use lots of spices, ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, black and red pepper, in these countries they have more cancer of the stomach and the esophagus than other places of the world. So that country of the world, no, turmeric is not as badly irritating as the others. People who live in those parts of the world where these spices are commonly used in foods on a daily basis lead the world. India has more cancer of the esophagus and stomach than any other country in the world. Number two country is Mexico, and the number three country, Korea. And this, yes, India?
No.
Oh, ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, black and red pepper. Those are the most irritating. There are others that are slightly irritating that could be used on a very infrequent basis. Not very infrequent, but not on a regular basis like daily, like turmeric. could be used occasionally. Yes.
The exercise machines were mentioned, and I know it's important to get the cardiovascular exercise. What about weight? Is that
use of weights? Yes, you may use weights, and they are also very good. Oh, yes. In fact, I think that women who are over the age of 50 should get some weights and some other exercise things, some hand grippers and some spring pulleys like this, and keep the shoulders strong. And weight lifting. Yes, these machines are good. Yes, and for women who can't exercise, have no purposeful labor that they can use, of course, join a spa or get some machines, because we need to stay in good physical condition through exercise.
And it's
oh yes, we can use these free weights. Using a hand gripper is good for glaucoma. Question here. What do you do if you have too much iron in the body? Garlic is a good thing. We can use that. Take it in fairly large quantities. Exercise is very good. Reducing our stresses by whatever means, that can all be very helpful. Question in the back.
What would your response be to a person that says that you have to take B12 supplements every day, but you don't want to be exposed?
What would be my response to someone who says you must take B12 if you're going to use no animal products? My response is that if you have a feeling of anxiety about it, just get a B12 supplement. Get the little wafers that you can chew and eat. And just take those, chew them at a meal, and make sure you chew them for at least half a minute, because it'll be absorbed better if it is. I have never had any anxiety over B12. I've never used a supplement, not even one. We do know that all of our nutrients can be obtained from fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. And if they can be, then why have an anxiety about B12? It's a nutrient, and it's present in there. And when I first became a total vegetarian, about, I guess, 23 or 24 years ago, my children were small. And there was nothing that frightened me worse than something that might cause ill health in my children. I didn't want anything in our program that would make my children have ill health. And we were told that we would only be able to store B12 that we've gotten from the meat and milk and eggs and cheese we'd eaten for 2 years. So the nutritionists were very loud and strong on that. So for the first 2 years, very regularly, we went down to my laboratory and blood was drawn and we checked B12 levels. Everybody was fine. Friends, but never felt better than since we've been total vegetarians. Well, we've learned now that the body stores B12 for 7 years. Well, 7 years, more testing, very frequently. 7 years went by, we never felt better. We don't take supplements, we're happy with our diet. We found that it's 12 years. And so we checked on for 12 years. In fact, we got in such a custom of it that we still do. We still check it. And it's been way over 2 decades. And none of us have any evidence of B12 deficiency. Some have said, well, it's accidental eggs and milk and so forth that you've eaten in other people's homes. It couldn't be much, because we very carefully avoid it everywhere we go.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.